netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is a free service of FXGuide.com. If you'd like to support FX Guide, you can become an FX Insider. FX Insider is our membership program that offers insiders access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Just click up the top on the FX Insider tab.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. In fact, we promise never to cut off the mic or play off our guests. Be sure to check out all our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. On today's show, we have three guests to talk about the film Oz, Great and Powerful. We have Scott Stechdick, who is the overall visual effects supervisor. He won an Academy Award for Spider-Man and is a three-time Oscar nominee. Francisco De Jesus is the digital effects supervisor. He's formerly Digital Domain and has been at ImageWorks for many years. He was in charge of the digital New York City environments on the first Spider-Man and has worked on all the Spider-Man films and is also CG supervisor on Alice in Wonderland. We also have Philip Huber, a master puppeteer who helped create The China Girl, a special collaboration between practical and CG to get the best performance. We're going to talk quite a bit about that. Sony Picture ImageWorks did over 1,100 shots for Oz. Let's join our Mike Seymour on a journey to Oz.
Kansas is full of good men. I don't want to be a good man. I want to be a great one.
You're gonna need this!
Sony Pictures ImageWorks Senior Visual Effects Supervisor Scott Stechdick has been working with director Sam Raimi and production designer Robert Stromberg to work up the aesthetics, the look, the visual effects of Oz the Great and Powerful since about July 2010. Their goal was to create an incredibly vivid, colourful, saturated and highly stylized environment for the Land of Oz. And in Oz, James Franco's character interacts with some digital characters, namely Finlay the Monkey, and China Girl, who is a fully digital porcelain character but was based on puppeteering done on set by the puppeteer who actually appeared in Being John Malkovich, or rather his puppetry work appeared there. The film was shot in stereo on Red Epix. It was shot natively, it wasn't converted. Principal photography began in about July 2011 and wrapped about December 2011 of the same year. We thought we'd focus in on just a couple of the aspects in this incredibly technically challenging production, namely the relationship between on-set and the post-production, or rather the animation work, and also just how these two digital characters were realized and the challenges they provided when placed in, of course, the big synthetic digital environments such as the Emerald City. I started by asking Scott what he'd done on set to provide something by the way of eyeline and something to interact with for the actors, but also to provide as reference to the animators in lighting and pulling off the performances they need to do for the digital characters of China Girl and the Monkey.
Well, the China Girl and Monkey were completely separate individual challenges in their own right, and so I'll go over them each on their own.
Sure.
For the China Girl, very early in the process, we came up with the idea of having a marionette on set, and we found this master puppeteer named Philip Huber, who he basically did the intro scene in Being John Malkovich. So he brings, you know, 40 years of experience of puppeteering to the table. And we found that our best, most effective takes were, we actually had him on set in, you know, a blue suit for where that helps. But he was puppeteering in real time with James Franco, interacting with the China Girl. And at the same time, we had the actor playing the China girl, Joey King, in a soundproof booth right off set. And James had an earwig in his ear. So the actor playing the China girl could have basically a conversation, and Joey King was also watching the monitor in the booth. And so it was kind of, we got this interesting hybrid of a conversation between two actors and also a visual interaction with a marionette. And then, of course, we painted out the marionette and put in our CG version of the marionette.
Well, while we're on the China girl, it struck me as one of the really difficult things that one has to do in character animation as a supervisor is find this line to walk between a character that we don't want squatching and stretching the way that a normal person would because they're made of a porcelain kind of material and in this case, you know, actually cracks and everything else. But by the same token, of course, you need to get expressiveness in. And you know, in the face, it has to move, and otherwise it would be literally a China doll. Was it hard to find that balance between a stiffness that you would need because it's a China doll and a lack of stiffness that you want because it's got to emote?
Well, the interesting thing is very early during shooting, everyone was so impressed by the marionette on set, even though all it could do was move its limbs and its head and blink its eyes. And Philip was able to really capture this amazing emotional performance with those kind of limitations. So, I mean, there was even talk at some point about just painting out these wires and actually letting the real marionette be in for as many shots as we could. But pretty quickly, Sam decided he didn't want to art direct the performance in post. So, but what we learned from that is that you can do a lot within restrictions, and so Troy Saliba and his animation team embraced those restrictions, and what they tried to do was limit internal movement on the face as much as possible, like particularly the eyebrows and their moves. And the way he got around that, aside from the same things that Philip had done with the marionette, was to hide expression changes either on cuts or within head turns, or just really balanced, trying to be subtle about them. And hopefully at the end of the day, you won't really see a lot of stretching of the skin. It'll be something that you still read the performance, but it's almost a subliminal thing, like where did that change happen? Or it should be hopefully mostly hidden.
I spoke to Philip Huber, the puppeteer in Being John Malkovich, and of course the man behind China Girl. Do you sit there and say, okay, breathing. Should I have this character breathing or not? You're trying to go to something that is in of itself ill-defined, as in, you know, does a China doll breathe?
Yes. For me, there was no question about that, because as a puppeteer, I'm taking a basic inanimate object and I'm giving it the illusion of life. That includes breath, that includes thinking, that includes feeling. And I wanted all of those qualities in China Girl. So the answer is, every chance I got, she would breathe, she would stop to think, she would do all those things. And a lot of that I was writing on the performance that Joey King was giving vocally. She and I were working together so that when she was watching a monitor and seeing the marionette do a little flinch or a special little action or pause in a certain way, she was following it vocally. And I was taking her vocal cues of excitement or sadness or whatever it could be, and I was translating that into the body language of the marionette.
So let's just set that up for people. So Joey is on set and providing in real time a great sort of actual performance by voice. You're on set live, obviously in a blue suit to be keyed out, providing a physical performance of the marionette, which is then allowing the actors to provide their good performance. I mean, is this super rehearsed? Because it seems to me that you and Joey could be chasing each other a little in that scenario.
It was not super rehearsed. That was the amazing thing. I thought Joey was such an incredible actor. I've worked with actors, you know, far more experienced than she, and they were not as sensitive to what was going on. She was very sensitive to the pacing of a marionette. A marionette has a certain pacing that it does things well. And if you try and push that envelope too much, then they start getting awkward. And she could see that and she could feel that, which was pretty amazing. But she was actually sitting in a booth, and in that booth she had monitors so that she could see what the camera could see. And her mic was going through a headset that I had on, and I could also hear the direction from Sam. And I could hear all the other actors who are mic'd as well. So I was completely in this blue suit with this headset and listening to her speak, and she was watching me perform and watching the other actors reacting with the puppet. And that was just all happening in real time. And basically our rehearsal was just when we do other takes.
So, I mean, obviously if you had a stand-in, I'm going to say prop now, for eyeline that just needs to be physically where it needs to be, you're providing performance. And so I'm wondering, key to any performance like that is when a character doesn't have any lines and you have to provide or come up with, I guess, bits of business. To do that, did you and Joey at all talk about backstory? I mean, how did you sort of decide what China Girl would do if she wasn't actually delivering a line but was listening, like her reaction, her approach to what was happening in a scene?
We did discuss that a little bit. Joey had certain things that she would like, and Sam would ask her that. He would ask, well, what would you do in this situation? And then she would say, well, I'd probably do this. But 9 times out of 10, Sam just went with things that I had come up with for the marionette to begin with. I just knew that I had this, as I said, a repertoire of movements, and I would go back to those to establish something to try and create the right effect for the moment.
I want to go with you.
What? On a witch hunt? No, you're just a little girl.
I'm not as delicate as I look.
That didn't hurt.
I'm coming with you.
Listen, we have one rule in show business. Never work with kids or animals. I'm already working with this thing. Relax. The answer's no. Don't do that. You're fine.
You're gonna leave me alone.
Look, you're fine.
On a rope. In the middle
of
nowhere.
All you have to do is take the Yellow Brick Road. You'll get there. It's crying again. What do I do? Oh, no. Off. Come on. Off. Off of there.
Please let me go.
Get off. No, get off of there. No dolls on the witch hunt!
It's great to have plate photography that includes the marionette. You get great eyeline from the actors, the animators can see what's going on, and of course there's good lighting reference. But then you have the problem of removing that marionette from shot so you can put the digital version in. I asked Francesco De Jesus, the digital effects supervisor from Sony, about whether or not they used the clean plates that maybe didn't have everything quite in the right place, or used the correct plates with the marionette in shot and then digitally removed it.
There's a couple of times when, well, some decisions were based on the numbers. If it's going to take this many weeks to paint it all out, and even then, because it's in stereo, we know there's going to
be
some
difficulties. Yeah, I was going to say, stereo paint out.
Yeah, it's painful. If it was less work to just go ahead and replace it with a CG limb or hand, whatever, we would do that. In a couple of cases, it was a creative call. It was simply that, actually one of those was a very few cases where they chose the take where James Franco was miming, where he was not holding anything. And as we normally expect, his hands are not in the right place. They might be too far apart or too close together or, not how they would be if he was physically holding the object. So we ended up just creatively choosing, let's keep one of the hands, and then let's replace the other and be able to move it into the place where it makes for a better shot.
Normally when somebody has a stand-in for eyeline, it doesn't actually get lit by the DP. So I asked Scott just how helpful it was to have the marionette in terms of the DP and lighting for a character that obviously could get lost. It's very small in shot and maybe would otherwise not stand out.
Well, I think we had a great advantage shooting with a marionette because a lot of times when you set up a stand-in in a shot, the DP doesn't really light for the stand-in. But our marionette had a real presence on set, and so the DP did a pretty hero lighting pass on the marionette. And so that was a great starting point. And of course, we did the standard ImageWorks dual sphere on set, so we got really, really great HDRIs. But the only other challenge we really had was that as a shiny porcelain, all white kind of character, she tended to dominate if we weren't careful, just because of how bright she could be. So it was more, the artistic exercise in lighting was more careful, selective shadowing of areas. And in particular, you probably even see it in some of the trailer shots. We did what Sam Raimi refers to as the Captain Kirk lighting, which is you kind of shadow the forehead and below the nose or right around the nose. So you kind of get the dramatic lighting across the eye and really feature the eyes, but it fades off into darkness other places. So we would go in and do custom lighting setups to feature her in different areas, but in general, the HDRIs were a great starting point.
As Philip was actually on set and had to move the character, you'd kind of assume that this would mean there'd be heaps of time for framing and camera moves that would easily allow the right amount of screen time for the China girl to, say, walk or do her blocking.
No, really, they did. That didn't happen. I had to create the performance whatever way I could create it. And most of the time, it worked out okay. I mean, sometimes I would lag behind a little bit because James Franco would be walking very quickly down the yellow brick road, and I had to find a way to keep up. And meanwhile, she's running into roots and stuff like that, so she's stopping and hopping over them. But I would find other little moments where I could suddenly catch up. So that just became part of the serendipity, I guess, of the performance. And there wasn't too much discussion about that between head of animation and things like that. They just were interested in what I was creating, I guess.
You've obviously done an enormous amount of live work in front of an audience, but one of the aspects that the animators discussed in terms of the China girl as she appears in the film is the taking advantage of the editing to change emotion. In other words, you could cut away and cut back, and you could have reposed the marionette, or in this case, the actual CG character, so that she maintained that illusion of not being just a child, but actually being a China. Were you kind of aware of that editing aspect, in that you didn't have to sort of, like a live performance, stage everything to get from A to B to C to D? You could just jump from A to D if you felt like it, as long as the camera move allowed that, of course.
Yes, I am aware of that because of being John Malkovich. Malkovich was the first time that, you know, I had to take a marionette through a very complex series of things and realize that the great advantage I had is I could stop, restring a marionette for specific movement and even touch up paint if I needed to on the face to slightly change the expression.
Are you referring to the Dance of Despair?
Yes.
Right.
But for China Girl, I could change stringing. She had to handle props various times, so I had to find out when she was required to do that, and then I had to rig her so that she could either pick up a prop or that she had a prop and she could move with it appropriately, and she could do various things between the two hands with the prop. She could maybe bring her hands together and hold that prop in both hands rather than just one. And again, it was the problem of, you know, we would be so freeform in the actual blocking of a scene once it got in front of camera that I had more than one time where I rigged her with a prop in one hand and it turned out it really needed to be in the opposite hand. And then I had to try and find a time to stop and quickly re-rig. But those kind of things, you know, I am aware of the fact that the great advantage of film is that you can cut and then move in and do precisely what you need to with the marionette to get the effect that they want right at that second.
So from your point of view, the performance you're providing of this character, being that she is from this smashed village and she is China, was there anything that you would pass on to the animators in terms of, well, I moved my character this way because of that character trait of being a China doll, as opposed to if I was marionetting someone that was meant to be much more squashy and stretchy and sort of flesh-like. Was there anything in that performance? Did you like walk any differently? Did you approach any of the movements differently?
No, it was because of the way I jointed her to begin with that it already gave her the right qualities for that. A marionette, if you really think about it, is pretty close to what they were looking for. A basic marionette movement would be pretty close to a China girl animated, you know, the way the parts would move. And she even made noises. She was made out of resin, of course, not porcelain at all, but she made these interesting little squeaks and noises when she moved. So she had all of these qualities built into her. And really, the animators just wanted me to do all the possible movements I could do with her so that they could just pick and choose, you know, what would work at various times. Basically, they followed my performance. When I saw the finished film, it virtually all of my performance with the character was there. Every once in a while, for artistic reasons, they would use an upstage arm instead of a downstage arm to create a movement that I had done anyway, but just switching arms or things like that. So they were changing the aesthetic very slightly.
So as I understand it, the marionette that you used for the character wasn't one that you were directly involved in making, though you had to modify her, or was there two of them? Can you give me the story on the actual marionette itself?
Well, they were vacillating. They had a special effects studio, K&B FX, which was doing a lot of the building of special things for the film, and they were intending to build the marionette. And I told them that specifically I needed it to work a certain way and that I had had problems in the past with other people making them and not understanding the demands that would be made upon the puppet for certain movements, and the jointing would have to be special. So they actually ended up saying, okay, fine, you build it. Now, K&B had already made a maquette. And so what I did was ask them just to cut apart the maquette into certain individual pieces, and I dictated the way the pieces needed to be cut. And then they sent those to me. And I had to join everything together and create a marionette out of that. It was actually a more difficult process than designing a marionette from scratch and then casting the parts specifically for that and building it. But each one of the marionettes was made, handmade that way. Each of the joints was done by hand. And so the two characters that I made, even though they were identical, they had a little bit of different personality in the way they moved and acted on screen.
It's really interesting, I think, that you did have to make two with slightly different personalities. So could you tell me, the range of motion is coming from about, what, 20 strings, as I understand? Is that right?
Yes. One of them had 20 strings and the other had 21.
And what was that fundamental difference that required the extra string and the extra model, or the extra marionette?
Well, the unique thing about this was that I told Sam Raimi when I first came on board this, or after he had invited me to come on board, was that for me, it's always best if I can see storyboards a day or so ahead of a scene, and then I can understand what sort of movements are required, and I can actually string and rehearse with the marionette to do those specific moves. But this film was so hectic, and the marionette was involved in so many scenes and very complicated ones, that it was almost impossible to do that. And as a matter of fact, Sam really likes to have input from the actors, including me. He included me in all of the jam sessions, I guess you would say, with the performers before each one of the major scenes, and we would discuss what was happening, and people would make suggestions for possible changes and things like that. So I was constantly having to do things just by the seat of my pants. I would just have to have the puppet do things right in front of the camera as we were shooting. And what I tried to do was get the largest repertoire of basic movements into the figure. And I knew that certain movements were going to translate as certain feelings with that character. So I had quite a range that I could use. And then between the two characters, one was strung very long strings, the other was strung with short strings to begin with. And that was because there were times where the figure would have to be held by James, and I would have to have my arm way up in the air and trying to manipulate, and other times it would be down on the ground running amongst the actors, and we thought we'd need longer strings for that. So that was the initial reason for the two marionettes with slightly different things going on.
So the range of motions at the joints, do you try to model those based on the range of motions of what a joint would do? And I mean, it's a bit odd to say it in a real person because obviously the character was going to be not a real person. She's China. But let's take an arm, for example. Like, is the arm joint able to only bend in a certain way, but the shoulder still allows rotation in the way that a biped humanoid does? Or do you have to have a much more flexible kind of range of motion for the elbow and then you just control it based on your skill with the strings?
Well, with a marionette, you try and give as much flexibility as possible, but you don't want it, when it goes to a rest position, you don't want it to flop into a position that looks unnatural or uncomfortable. Those are things to avoid. So with the marionette, you actually sometimes restrict the movement. The shoulder movement is left very, very free, and we had to discuss changes in the design of the character so that it would allow me to make a shoulder joint that was very free. The elbow joint is restricted. It is a basic one-way movement. There's no rotation in the elbow. Now, they had designed a ball and socket joint, basically, for all of her joints. I had to modify that and make it so it was what you would call a tongue-in-groove joint. And that was for the knees and for the ankles and for the elbows. The wrist was given a full ball rotation like the human wrist. And it was a special joint that I had created for that marionette. I'd never made anything like it before.
So in the wrist, for example, I mean, if I'm holding my wrist, I can't turn it more than maybe about 160 degrees. Is there that kind of restriction? Or you could, if in the wrong circumstances, actually have the wrist sort of twist around 270 degrees?
No, it was limited. It was limited to the range that the human wrist could go. So again, she couldn't throw her hands into an awkward position.
And then the head, that must be, because you only had, what, the eyes, there was no other facial expression. So for you to perform, you must need tremendous control on the neck and the head.
That's correct. I was really intent on the head movement. And in order to get maximum head action, I asked to have a joint at the base of the neck. The design of the character was with a smooth chest running right up to the neck, and they didn't want a joint there. I said I absolutely had to have it to give her the range of motion for her head that would be required so that she could focus anywhere she needed, on camera, off camera, or to any one of the actors, no matter how tall. And for that reason, they actually changed that in the CG. That was the big difference between the marionette and the CG character. She has no mark at the base of her neck, no joint there, and the marionette did.
So something like, say, the eyes, which I presume most of the time are open, is that under constant control, or is it sort of springed open and then you can, you know, partially or fully close it as is? Because, I mean, 20 strings, you don't have that many fingers.
Well, yeah, you have a special control bar, it's called, that you design so that you get an awful lot of action just by tilting, rotating that bar. And then you go in and you do pluck individual strings between your two hands. But people often visualize marionettes as one string for each finger, and it's definitely not that. You're always using a combination of strings and sometimes opposing forces between two different strings at the same time to create the movement.
So what's
the eyes were sprung open, and so when I would pull on the string, I could partially close them or close them all the way and give her different expression.
So what was your weight point? Like, what's carrying the majority of the weight of the marionette? Is it a hip-based? Because, I mean, if this was a person in a flying rig, I'd have them with most of their weights from their waist. Or is it from the head and everything sort of hangs below that with control? I mean, what is the weight point?
That's right. The head holds the weight of the marionette. and then you pull the weight off using other basic strings to the body. So the shoulder string is the best example of that. By pulling weight off of the head on the shoulder string, you can actually tip the head forward and rotate it then side to side. So she can look down and look across side to side.
So it seems to me that one of the sort of inexperienced nature of puppeteers who aren't as experienced as you, and obviously you're very experienced, is you tend to get a hip and shoulder movement that almost like they're, to get them round, you almost get like a sort of a throwing of the weight to bring a leg around and a throwing of the weight the other way to bring the other leg around, which gives you a shoulder joint and a hip joint which are moving in sync as opposed to in against each other as you would sort of tend to expect in a normal biped. Do you have anything to sort of control that? Because you seem to get this tremendous fluidity of movement that I often don't see in someone less experienced.
Wow. Well, I'm not sure I've analyzed that completely to know exactly what's going on. I know how I want the footfall to happen with the marionette, and I know just by the way I construct the body, which is called a counterbalanced body that was designed originally by a puppeteer in the United States called W.A. Dwiggins. And that body works pretty close to the human body so that you don't have to worry too much about the hip being independent of the shoulders. It just seems to do that in a very nice way. And that was the main thing that I had to do with these marionettes, is even though the maquette had a body that they had molded, I couldn't use it at all. I had to start from scratch and completely carve the body of each one of these marionettes out of wood and using the counterbalance technique to get the correct movement for the torso. And I knew it didn't matter because the torso was completely covered by her costume.
And wasn't there also wardrobe changes based on the dress?
There were several wardrobe changes, yes. I have to tell you that originally she was designed so that even her clothes were going to be porcelain. And that was going to be problematic. It was going to be cheaper for them to turn her into CG that way.
Much harder to sit down.
As far as moving as a marionette, it was absolutely impossible. And I had to explain that to the producers and everybody up front, and Sam wanted to see it as well. And so they took a marionette that I already had of a little girl, and we actually costumed her in stiff cardboard pieces. And I had already shown, I had done a screen test with her to show all the movements that I could get doing two key scenes from the film, from the script, rather. And so then Sam wanted to see those same scenes after she had the cardboard. And then he could see the extreme limitations. And my advice was that they please go to soft cloth for her costume and not try to do the stiff china.
You're really going to do this?
How hard could it be to kill a Wicked Witch?
Hard! Really hard. It's very, very hard to kill a Wicked Witch. And what about that poor girl back there? I think she really liked you.
She'll get over me. They always do. A pretty young witch. There'll be plenty of wizards knocking at her door.
Oh, every lie you tell gets us one step closer to the Emerald City dungeon.
And don't think of them as lies. Think of them as stepping stones on the road to greatness.
Wait, I got it. We'll turn around and go back.
And that was, of course, the voice of Finley, the flying monkey that accompanies Oz throughout his journey. And I asked Scott about comparing and contrasting what they had on set for the monkey, the winged monkey character, compared to the China Girl.
Where our China Girl was like this interpretation between the marionette and then Joey King's performance, the monkey was more complicated because it was a combination of features of a real monkey versus, and the type we picked was a Capuchin monkey, features of that versus a design monkey versus pieces of Zach Braff versus a bird, because it's a flying monkey. And we didn't really have a great proxy on set in terms that could capture everything that the marionette did for the China Girl. So what we did, which is pretty much, you know, standard practice nowadays, is you really put the actor in on set and get the real face-to-face interaction. So anytime we could put Zach Braff in on set and get his head at the proper head height of the monkey, we would. And, you know, I mean, obviously that's been done a lot recently in, you know, Lord of the Rings with Gollum and just most visual effects movies out there. And, I mean, we've been doing it since, I think, like, Hollow Man was the first time I really did that, and working with Scott Anderson on that. And it's like, it was so valuable to have the actor on set that whenever you can do that, you want to.
I'm so glad you brought up Hollow Man, because I think that's a really terrific film, both, well, mainly in terms of technical advances. I don't know that history has been as generous to it as it should have. And I was interested to see if we could actually reference Hollow Man, because I was wondering, from a technical point of view, as a supervisor and sort of looking at what's going on, Hollow Man was so spectacular. But, you know, there's a lot of time that's passed since then. I was just wondering where you found most of the technological benefit between then and now.
When I look back on Hollow Man, and I haven't watched it for a while, I think the thing that was really ahead of its time was building the character from the inside out. And I think, you know, most high-end rigging now is really doing a lot of that work, the bone structure and then building proxy muscles on top of it. And I feel like a lot of that work still really holds up. I feel like we've made so many lighting advances now that going back, if I were to do that again, I think that the lighting would be probably 2 to 3 steps forward of where we were there. But I can't really fault, like, all the muscle and, like, sub-skin structure that was built and modeled and rigged and animated back then.
You wouldn't have had subsurface scattering back then, would you? So when you're saying lighting, are you meaning rendering or the getting the lighting right on the model?
I would say both lighting and rendering. I mean, I think that there were crude versions of image-based lighting going on there in terms of trying to reconstruct what was on set, but nothing near as sophisticated as the capture methods we have now. And, I mean, you know, methods like capturing and then reprojecting back so you actually know not just light position, but all the, you know, all the environmental contributions just bouncing off of adjacent surfaces and indirect illumination. So I think just, like, capturing the lighting environment has advanced quite a bit. And then, of course, you know, shading techniques are far more advanced now than they were then.
So let's talk about animation for a second. On something like Hollow Man, you have this great reference. Obviously, it's meant to be a guy. I mean, there was the gorilla talk, but let's talk about the guy. He's a guy, so you've got yeah, great reference in an actor, and notwithstanding the changes in technology, one of the things that you don't have for Oz is there just is no animal. There's no mammal. There's nothing that you can reference that has six limbs that has some structure like a winged biped. And so it introduces this complete problem of how do I actually handle the physics of that? Because the structure of a monkey isn't that of a bird. And by the same token, you know, you've got to have this extra sort of weird muscle and bone structure. Was it hard to work out how to make that sort of, given how much detail you put into what happens under the surface of a creature like or character like this?
Yeah, and I mean, I think once you go into that territory, it's a bunch of artistic choices rather than physically based choices. And I mean, when I was working with Troy on what that design and what that structure was, we very purposely picked like an elliptical type bird wing because we knew like that the animation style of this monkey was going to be quick, highly maneuverable movements. And so it was really just an artistic choice about what kind of things do we want to do with this monkey, and let's actually build a wing structure that's compliant with that and respects that. And then just the needs of each shot really dictated how Troy and his team animated that. But I actually, that actually brings me back to the on-set work in a weird way, because before kind of we went down the Holloman discussion, there is one thing that I wanted to talk about.
Sure.
And that when we couldn't have Zach on set there with his face, like face-to-face with James, like because he was a flying monkey and because he would fly up and hover and then land, and he was really agile on set and maneuverable, the best thing that I could come up with was instead of the classic tennis ball on a stick, we ended up doing kind of, I called it puppet cam, but it was really as simple as a monitor and a camera on a stick. So we set up almost like a two-way video conference that was puppeteered. So in other words, if the monkey was flying, you know, from a tree stump up to in front of James's face, we actually would have a puppeteer with a blue rod and a monitor attached to it. And on that monitor was a direct feed to Zach in a booth offset. And Zach was seeing a video feed from the camera attached to that same monitor on a stick. So basically, when we couldn't get Zach's head in the place where the monkey's head was, we used this puppet cam setup as a proxy for that. And I think that was really, really beneficial to us to get that same face-to-face performance in a way where we wouldn't have if we had a tennis ball on a stick.
Right.
And that was important to us because all those like artistic decisions about what the monkey was doing, I mean, they're driven mostly from, I would say, the interaction between James and Zach on set. And Zach would do this incredible amount of like improv, and they would just have this dialogue, and then Troy and this animation team would go back and try to figure out what body movements and what wing movements and what action would accommodate that.
Was your sort of thinking that the wings were arms to be expressive or to just come out when flight was needed and let's not overkill the... Because the other thing that's curious about a shot with the monkey is that, you know, you've got fur, very, very obvious fur and very obvious feathers, and they don't go together naturally either.
No. And in fact, you know, we tried to soften the look of the feathers with just fine, almost fur-like tufts at the interfaces near the top, like near the secondary feathers, like you'll get in a lot of elliptical wings. So we tried to visually soften the connection between the fur and the feathers. But in terms of animation of them, they weren't incredibly featured in a lot of the dialogue settings, and I do think that they were posed very subtly to work with the emotion of the dialogue, but mostly they were for moving him around and hovering around and just complementing his balance. I mean, there were a lot of decisions about where his center of gravity was in terms of like where his hands are and where his tail was and where his wings are, and making that all visually work.
And then you went a different route with the baboons because their wings don't have that kind of fur-like approach, do they? They have much more like a leathery kind of approach.
That's right, where the monkey's wings were more based on traditional birds, the baboon wings are based on bats and inspired by bat design. And I think it was really just based on, we very visually wanted to separate the good monkeys versus the bad monkeys. And so the whole style of the baboons were more predatory, and they were heavier and less maneuverable and not as smart. And, you know, when they would take off or land or dive, I mean, we had to respect their extra mass and their, you know, sort of wing to mass ratio, and reference larger size birds as opposed to the small maneuverable ones.
Thank you. city. You are here at last, and the prophecy shall be fulfilled.
Francesco, the characters have to be placed in an environment, and here we have massive set extensions and, of course, a lot of just fully digital environments. Was the look of those digital environments, was the nature of those digital environments worked out in concept art or previs, or did you have to kind of find your way through to them?
For Emerald City, a lot of it was very, very well laid out in concept artwork. Even some, there's two types of concept art. There's what we all know of concept art, and then there's a second category called paintovers. The paintovers are after the fact, after they shot something. Rob Stromberg, the production designer, would take a still image from what they shot from the main camera, and then replace a blue screen and paint over it, and then give us as a reference. But anyway, going back to this, there was good concept art of Emerald City, even from the beginning, from day one, that showed us what they wanted to do was kind of a large scope. They wanted to have a very cosmopolitan look, Art Nouveau style of architecture and details. The only thing that really changed from concept to final execution was going more emerald and less of the gold detail highlights. There was more of that originally, and then we did actually model and texture it in the course of lighting and presenting the shots. We ended up toning that down a lot.
Is there any generalities in terms of these CG environments that, like, you know, giant poppy fields is easier than Chinatown, which has got lots of sort of broken but man-made shapes and reflections, or Emerald City for that matter? Were there, you know, in approaching this, did any one of those present more of a problem than another?
Certainly all of the outdoors in nature with foliage, that kind of thing. Emerald City, I think, because of many shows that we've done now doing CG cities, whether it be New York or anything more fantastical than that, we have a really good way of doing the model, the layout, etc. But for outdoors, for walking around a grassy field or through a forest, it simply came down to how much detail, how much geometry we could try to stuff into the frame before we would hit the memory limit. And that was the determining factor. We would keep adding. We would add another 100 trees, another 1,000 trees. Let's change the trees with ones that are bigger, more leafy. Let's add more flowers and more grass, everything, until we would hit that limit. And then, okay,
Is that limit a poly count limit? Is it a memory on the blade server limit? Is it, I mean, where's that actual limit?
It's the memory. It's about 24 gigs of RAM is what we have on our render servers.
Right.
And we were very, very efficient as far as looping, instancing, using as many tricks as we could, the most distant. Like if you were looking at many trees, maybe the more distant ones became cards, and even beyond that, it was a map painting. But even so, there's so much. One of the things that creatively there was a choice made that made things perhaps a little more difficult for us was we normally rely on some haze and some depth healing for atmosphere to say that's very distant.
Yep.
You know, if you have two mountains, one of them will be a little bit more flashed, and then that tells you that's farther away because there's more atmosphere. Well, they really wanted the air and the sky and everything in the land of Oz to be crystal clear. So you could see everything from the blade of grass that's in front of Oz all over the horizon with such clarity that there's less that we could get away with. And add to that a couple of shots with these huge flying type camera moves, and it's in stereo, and we just have to go with more and more and more geometry.
I imagine that the bubble, magic bubble flight sequence was exactly one of those, right? Covering a lot of ground.
Oh, yeah. Indeed it was.
Is that a case where you were, like, seriously worried about memory limits?
Yeah, well, I don't want to say it was worrying because we knew that going in. These are huge shots. essentially, what can we do to make it as beautiful as possible before we hit any kind of limiting factor. Bubble Voyage went through a couple of different types of elements. It starts in clouds, so we start with some very heavy, difficult to render volumetric clouds. Then we go into an area which is populated by giant crystals, which actually, truth be told, that was the one that was the most scary. Simply going into this, some of us had worked on Green Lantern before, and there were some crystals there, and knowing the amount of ray tracing and refraction and the noise issues in the render, that was going to be a big one. And then add on top of that all the foliage. Bubble Voyage then continues. There's an area where they fly over these giant rock formations that look like animals. Like there's a giant elephant and a hippo and a lion. And you fly really just right past them. And so I consider Bubble Voyage to be like three or four very, very large outdoor environments all kind of rolled back to back.
Oz is a really interesting technical film. It has so many wonderful aspects. And I have to say, from FX Guide's point of view, researching this, it was just a joy to discuss the relationship between on-set and post-production. And to that end, I just want to swing back and not as an afterthought, but as just a perhaps out-of-sequence section, bring to you in closing the comments that Philip the Puppeteer made. We'd finished the interview pretty much, and I was just discussing with him, you know, the relationship he had between the himself and the actors, because I'd read that he'd gone to great lengths to try and make himself invisible so the actors would pay attention to the puppet. And I expected him to talk about that, but I got a completely different answer in terms of how he felt about this experience of being on set. And it's just such a great call out, I guess, to us all to be collaborative and considerate on set, that I thought we'd finish out this FX podcast by having a listen to, in closing, this remarks from Philip discussing working with James Franco, but also with the director on Oz the Great and Powerful.
Well, it's wonderful. You know, I was trained as an actor, so I'm used to reacting, and it was just great to have this experience as a puppeteer. It's unusual for me. I've just worked as an actor, or I've worked as a puppeteer, but this combination of having the puppet react from a live actor and having the live actor react from the things that the puppet is doing is just such a great experience. And I found so much grace that was expressed by Michelle Williams when I had scenes with her. I mean, there were some lovely little scenes between China Girl and Michelle, which again didn't make it into the finished film, but they were just so much fun to shoot because there was that great rapport between the two of them. And James was great because when I was having trouble early on in the process, I was afraid to ask for a monitor the first day I was on the shoot. I had stated that I would need a monitor with reverse sweep so that I could glance into it and be able to tell right away if the marionette was focused into camera. And when it came time for a close-up and James was holding China Girl, I was afraid to ask for that monitor because I hadn't been on a set with like 200 people standing around waiting to get things done. And so I pushed ahead to do what I needed to do. And James, we did a take, and the China Girl, sure enough, her focus went off camera. And so Sam asked me to try it again. And the next time, I could feel James just slightly rotating his hand to compensate for China Girl. So even though I didn't have the monitor, here was my fellow actor helping me, assisting me in this little way, which was really wonderful. So it's things like that made this entire shoot such a treat. The people were great to work with. They were all very professional. And Sam Raimi is probably one of my favorite directors of all time because he has such a gentle but commanding way of moving the entire process along. And that is really important. He listens so well, and he gives direction so simply, but it's so effective. And it's just a very gentle process, which I think artists thrive in that sort of a situation. I've worked in situations where it's been very rough, where a director is very demanding and loses patience and things like that. And there was nothing like that here. It was a fantastic experience.
Thanks to Scott, Francisco, and Philip for taking time with us. I think this kind of conversation, moving beyond the tennis ball for eyelines, using tools to enhance performance, making the actors more comfortable, you know, giving them a chance to do a better performance is very interesting. And coming on the heels of the Hobbit discussion about the two adjoining sets with scaled rooms, I think we're seeing more and more of this clever problem solving to enhance performances. And in fact, our business has strong roots in the creative problem solving area. The Hobbit gag reminded me of work that was done back on the TV show Cosmos from a company called Magicam. I looked it up and it won a 1981 Emmy for Creative Technical Crafts. It was the work of folks like Joe Mazza, who later founded CIS Hollywood, and Doug Trumbull. Probably the most famous scene featured Carl Sagan walking through a miniature of the Alexandria Library with one camera shooting the model and a scaled camera shooting Sagan on a blue screen stage. We work hard at FX Guide to keep you up to date on the latest visual effects news. The site is run by 3 visual effects artists, and we are really passionate about covering visual effects. And we want to do that, not sell banner ads or clutter the site with ads. Over the years, people have asked, how can we help? So we created the FX Insider membership program. FX Insiders unlock access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work that we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow, and it's only $49 a year for you to support the site, and it makes a huge difference. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. This has been the FX Podcast, but we also produce other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produced a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And don't forget our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.